President Joe Biden heads to Israel for a solidarity visit 11 days into its war with Hamas and to send a message to Iran and its other proxies not to escalate the conflict. Iran-born British-American actress and activist Nazanin Bonyadi says Iran is using the war to distract from human rights abuses at home.
I want to keep the focus on the people of Iran because my heart bleeds for the innocent civilians in the region who are dying because of the Islamic Republic's policies.
And the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Iran raises the alarm about a proposed law toughening penalties for women who ignore Islamist dress codes.
There is a real concern about gender apartheid taking place in Iran, and I am going to highlight that in my next report.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We begin this first anniversary edition of the program with news that President Biden departed Washington late Tuesday to fly to Israel as its war with Hamas enters a 12th day and threatens to widen after days of smaller-scale skirmishes between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah. The conflict began with Hamas infiltrators launching a surprise terror attack on southern Israel on October 7th, killing at least 1,400 Israelis, mostly civilians. Israel has reported killing around 1,500 Palestinian attackers, while Hamas authorities in Gaza have reported 3,000 Palestinian deaths in Israeli counterstrikes on Hamas targets. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed Iran's connection to the conflict on Tuesday as he met visiting German Chancellor Olaf Scholz.
This is a part of an axis of evil of Iran and Hezbollah and Hamas. Their goal, open goal, is to eradicate the state of Israel.
Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who praised Hamas's terror attack as an epic victory, said Tuesday that Israel must stop its counterstrikes on Hamas and Hezbollah immediately. Speaking in Tehran, he said if the crimes of the Zionist regime, a reference to Israel, continue, Muslims and resistance forces will become impatient and no one can stop them. Biden's latest public comment on Iran's connection to the war came in an interview last Thursday with U.S. network CBS's 60 Minutes program.
Now, Iran constantly supports Hamas and Hezbollah. I don't mean that. But in terms of did they have foreknowledge? Did they help plan the attack? There's no evidence of that at this point.
Speaking in Tel Aviv early Tuesday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Biden's first goal in visiting Israel will be to hear its defense needs.
Second, President Biden will underscore our crystal clear message to any actor, state or non-state, trying to take advantage of this crisis to attack Israel. Don't. To that end, he's deployed two aircraft carrier groups and other military assets to the region.
The Israel-Hamas conflict was a topic of conversation at a Washington conference last Thursday held by the National Union for Democracy in Iran, or NUFDI, a nonprofit and nonpartisan Iranian-American organization. I was the moderator for a panel on the human rights situation in Iran and what impact, if any, the war is having on it. The panelists included actress and activist Bonyadi in person and UN Special Rapporteur Javaid Rehman via video link. The panel began with a video presentation by NUFDI calling for more targeted sanctions on Iranian authorities suspected of rights abuses against the Iranian people. In the discussion, I asked Rehman whether there is international momentum for that approach.
That's an important question. If you look at my recommendations, I have campaigned that these targeted sanctions, they must be effective. And currently, if you look at the various entities, for example, the United States or the UK or the European Union or states within the European Union, they have these sanctions against individuals. But I think there needs to be a cohesive effort to ensure that these sanctions are placed against individuals after established evidence that they have committed serious crimes against international law, crimes against humanity, torture, very serious violence. But then these individuals somehow have to be impacted by these sanctions. In many cases, as I say, the effect is not so strong because they're individual sanctions. They are not affected because they do not have assets which can be frozen, or they don't have properties. They don't travel to these countries. So it may not prove to be that effective ultimately. And that's why we continue to see violations taking place in some instances, very serious violations taking place by these individuals, because they remain undeterred by these sanctions.
Nazanin, what is your view of the utility of continuing to have the West identify individuals, designate them for sanctions? Do you have the sense that it's more symbolic, or do you think it could actually make a difference?
I think it's symbolic when we don't enforce sanctions. Sanctions only work when they're enforced. So one example is oil revenues with Iran, which have increased by $15 billion since the initial year of implementation of the JCPOA. So as long as we don't enforce these sanctions, they're not going to work. And it's really as simple as that. But I do think targeted sanctions and Magnitsky sanctions are very important. They've proven to be important historically. But that's why I mentioned a multinational approach. And I agree with Mr. Rahman. If there is no cohesive way of dealing and approaching with this on an international front, then we're doomed. Because, I've been meeting with international lawmakers. One country will tell me one thing, another country will tell me something else. And I'm thinking, are you not communicating with each other? Because I know that autocrats, we've seen this in recent history and past weeks, they're very good at communicating and supporting each other. And yet we seem to consistently fail on that front. We don't have a way of being united in dealing with dictators and repression. So I think that's what's really needed.
Can you share anything, Nazanin, about kinds of officials, governments you've met with and discussed this topic with?
Yes, the UK government, the US government, obviously, German officials, European officials. I'm about to go to Australia and meet with Australian lawmakers. It's really the message that I'm trying to communicate to all of them is please unite. Because at the end of the day, the Islamic Republic has stayed in power and been able to oppress the Iranian people because of its policy of divide and rule. And the only antidote to that is for us to unite and empower the Iranian people. It's really as simple as that. So that's what I'm trying to convey, is all of our policies with regards to Iran or the Islamic Republic need to be that we unite and empower the people.
Javed, another mechanism that you've described for dealing with impunity, actually in a report that you submitted to the UN General Assembly in August, at the very conclusion of that, you had some recommendations. And you also talked about this idea of universal jurisdiction, of having countries try to prosecute Iranian officials accused of rights violations when those officials happen to be in the territories of those countries. Can you share anything about recent examples of universal jurisdiction being applied, and how effective a tool do you think that can be?
Yes, thank you. Again, that's a great question. You see, where there is absence of accountability domestically, and that's what I said to you just a minute ago, then we have to look internationally. And the use of universal jurisdiction in this regard is a very important mechanism, because what the universal jurisdiction does is to allow another state or another jurisdiction to hold individuals accountable for the crimes that they have committed in another jurisdiction. So, for example, when individuals commit very serious crimes in international law, such as the crime of torture or crimes against humanity, if these individuals are apprehended elsewhere in another jurisdiction, the courts of that country can take account of the individuals. They can arrest those individuals. They can try those individuals and ultimately convict them for very serious crimes in international law or grave crimes such as torture or crimes against humanity. And that is what we saw. And I mentioned to you the Hamid Nouri case, that this is what happened in Sweden, that Mr. Nouri was apprehended, arrested, charged, and then convicted last year for war crimes and murder, for the very serious role that he played in the mass executions of 1988. So therefore, I think universal jurisdiction is an important aspect a tool for holding serious violators of human rights accountable, even though in their own countries they enjoy impunity and immunity. But these are serious criminals. They must not escape justice, and therefore courts outside of their own countries must take cognizance of this important principle in international law, that is the universal jurisdiction.
Javed, when you think about the conversations you've had with UN member states, do you get a sense that there is an appetite beyond just Sweden to exercise universal jurisdiction? And how worried do you think Iranian officials are about this concept being applied to them if they travel overseas?
Yes, in my interaction with various governments, this issue has been raised. And in fact, as I mentioned to you, we have a case of Hamid Nouri now setting up a precedent. So there is that recognition. And universal jurisdiction is a well-established principle in international law. We've had instances in the past where individuals have been charged and convicted based on universal jurisdiction. And therefore, I encourage members of the United Nations to ensure justice. And that is one of the strongest tools in the armory of international law, to ensure that criminals, individuals who have committed very serious recognized crimes in international law, do not escape justice. And therefore, I think that the international community is looking towards using universal jurisdiction to hold individuals accountable.
Javed, I'd like to see if you can give us an update on the next reporting that you will be doing on Iran as part of your mandate. If you could share with our audience what kind of reporting it's going to be, when it's going to be issued, and if you can give us any preview of what those reports might say.
Yes, thank you. So your audience might be interested that I am traveling to the United States at the end of next week. I'll be presenting to the General Assembly in the third week. I think it's the 24th of October. And I will be presenting to the General Assembly on issues of key concerns, a summary of what I have already detailed in my report, which is published and which you have referred to. Now, insofar as the next report is concerned, but the next report would be submitted to the Human Rights Council. I'm currently working on it. And again, as in my previous work, I would be looking to engage with victims and with individuals who have concerns, with relevant stakeholders, with governments, with all forms of entities, to assess the very concerning and very worrying developments in Iran that are taking place there. The human rights situation is dire. It is becoming much worse. There is a lot of repression. I mean, one of the big concerns that we have now is the bill currently before the lawmakers about enforced hijab and its potential repercussions, which I'm afraid is going to lead us to something which I have said on numerous occasions, which is going to result in a form of gender apartheid, you see. So there is a real concern about gender apartheid taking place in Iran, and I am going to highlight that in my next report to look at the various forms of gender apartheid that are practiced both in the criminal laws of Iran as well as in the civil law. I mean, this is a very disturbing situation that women are subjugated, harassed, ostracized, excluded, and targeted and victimized. They have no fundamental rights, even to the extent that they cannot express themselves. You know, the enforced hijab law is going to become operational. And so what has the international community learned from last year? There has been nationwide demonstrations, but to what effect? What has the Iranian authorities done about it? So I'm going to highlight and expose the Iranian authorities on the worst crimes that they are committing in my next report. Thank you.
Speaking of the ongoing rights violations in Iran, I want to turn to Nazanin now. And the world's attention obviously has shifted somewhat in the last couple of days away from those ongoing violations inside Iran to what's been happening with the Israel-Hamas war that is now, I think, in its sixth day. So what I wanted to ask you, you've been quite vocal on social media, on Instagram and X, about how you see Iran's role in this conflict and how you see that Iran's long-time provision of monetary support and weaponry to Hamas should be, in your view, another reason that the international community should shun the Islamic Republic. What can you share with our audience about what you're hearing from people inside Iran, how they feel about this conflict that just erupted and how it might ultimately affect them?
I mean, let's talk about indisputable facts. We see videos coming from sports arenas where sports fans very clearly articulated where they stand.
You're talking about a soccer match that just happened.
Yes. We can also point to the Islamic Republic officials' celebration of the gruesome terror attacks by Hamas on Israelis. We can also point to the fact that 70% of Hamas's funding has come from the Islamic Republic. Actually, that they've gloated yesterday on state TV, the Islamic Republic gloated that they helped with this attack. So these are the indisputable facts. Also, it conveniently for the Islamic Republic has ruined the Saudi-Israeli normalization process. It has completely diverted attention away from domestic oppression of the Iranian people. So these are the undisputable facts. And the fact that Hamas is an Islamic Republic proxy is also indisputable and is furthering the aims of the regime. So with that in mind, I want to keep the focus on the people of Iran because my heart bleeds for the innocent civilians in the region who are dying because of the Islamic Republic's policies. So we have to point the finger towards the people who are responsible, and that is the Islamic Republic authorities. But for 44 years, we've only dealt with the symptoms of the problem vis-a-vis Iran, the nuclear issue, domestic oppression, regional aggression, terrorism, hostage taking, which of course we're seeing Hamas also engage in from the Islamic Republic playbook. What we haven't dealt with is the cause. The cause is the Islamic Republic theocratic regime. And so it makes it even more important that we condemn and hold this regime accountable. And so when I think about what's happening inside Iran, I think about Armi Togerovand, still in a coma after almost 2 weeks. There are also reports that she's been kept alive by machines to avoid further protests. I hope that Armita stays alive and she recovers to be able to someday see a free and democratic Iran. I also want to point to the families who continue to bravely seek accountability for their loved ones, for the persecution and execution of their loved ones, the murder of their loved ones. Mahmoudi Mulayrad, the mother of 9-year-old Kian Pirfalak, who's reportedly currently under house arrest. Mr. Karami, who's sought justice for his son, and is currently in prison being tortured, reportedly. The countless people inside Iran, like Fatemeh Sepehri and Nagaz Mohammadi, and the list goes on and on, of people who deserve our attention. And again, I want to emphasize, the root cause is what we need to address here, and it is the Islamic Republic regime.
Nazanin, you just mentioned Nargis Mohammadi, and her Nobel Peace Prize is another development that has been somewhat overshadowed by the war that has been unfolding between Israel and Hamas. The Iranian government acknowledged the award. They downplayed it. Nargis Mohammadi herself, we know through her family, heard about the award and celebrated it in her own way with her fellow prisoners. What do you think is her fate as she remains imprisoned and as we see the United States and others in the West call for her immediate release?
Well, as we saw in the case of Navid Afkari in 2020, despite international outrage, he was executed, showing the utter contempt of this regime for the rule of law. So what I can say is it helps to shine attention on these prisoners. It helps that Nargis Mohammadi has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. It helps for us to continue focusing on their cases. But please don't ever think that because we do, they will be saved. And we need to continue to keep the pressure on them. What we do know for sure is that the regime continues to kill in the dark. So where we fail to shine a light on these cases, the chances of them being tortured and executed is much, much higher.
Well, Nazanin, what can you tell us about what you and other activists have been doing to try to help the people in Iran who are fighting for freedom to improve their situation?
Thanks for the question. I can speak for myself. I don't know what other people are up to, but I do know that more and more people have come forward and stepped up in the past year, and it's really refreshing to see our unity and our continued work on this front. So many people care about the people inside Iran now. And what I've been focused on is in 1979, in the Islamic Revolution, there was a network, the mosque network, for example, that Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, used for his propaganda to get the international community galvanized around his campaign, if you will. And what we've lacked, I think, in 44 years is a concerted network, effort and network internationally that would help galvanize and amplify the people of Iran on an international scale. So I've really been focused. I can't go into details, unfortunately, because it does put people at risk. But internationally, there needs to be a network, which I'm working on, of bringing organizations and individuals into a position of reflecting the needs of their counterparts in Iran. And that's all I can really say currently. But it needs to be an international campaign and system in place to mirror what Khomeini had in 79, which was the mosque network.
Nazanin, as you try to build this network of activists to amplify the voices of people in Iran, can you tell us anything about the kinds of connections that you have made with people inside Iran? I know there's a lot of sensitivity regarding that issue. And what has been the impact, the response to this idea of forming a network?
I think they're urging us to form a network. They're saying, look, the prominent dissident Majid Tavakkoli said to The Guardian in the UK, our hands are tied inside Iran. We cannot create these networks. We can't do this kind of operational activity that we can do outside of Iran. So their request and their demand really for the international community is, we don't need you to save us, but please, can you at least get organized and unite and set aside your differences and just work towards a free and democratic Iran? We will do the rest on our side. We're risking our lives, in fact, to do everything on our side, is what they're telling me. But please, can you just organize? And that's really, I think, what is incumbent upon us is to do exactly that. We are millions strong around the world. I think we reportedly have $2.5 trillion between us internationally, the diaspora. Surely, with the brain drain that happened, surely with the intellect that we have in the diaspora, surely with the money we have in the diaspora, we can use not only our voices, but our votes to impact change. And that, I think, is the main message they're saying, is wherever you are as Iranians in the world, use your voices, use your votes to impact change.
And Javed, in the minute that we have left, final thought from you. And also, if you could tell us, you've been in the role for 5 years. What are your future plans? How much longer do you think you're going to be working on these issues?
Yes, thank you. I would say that I'm very thankful and grateful to the Iranian diaspora, to the civil society, to the international community who have supported me in my endeavors to highlight my concerns of the violations of human rights that are taking place in Iran. And as I said, I will be in New York at the General Assembly, so I would welcome interaction from the civil society or anyone who wants to see me. They're most welcome to come and approach me. As regards my mandate, if you look at the Human Rights Council special procedures, the mandates are limited to 6 years for every independent expert. So as you know, you mentioned, I started my mandate in July 2018. And next year, I would be finishing my personal mandate. That is that I would have had the honor to be the independent expert for 6 years, which I think has served me very well. I'm grateful to the international community, to the United Nations, and to the civil society to have given me that platform to raise my concerns. But I very much hope that the mandate continues to serve its purpose and to serve the Iranian people and the international community once I step down next year.
That was UN Special Rapporteur Javed Rehman. And that's all for the show. My thanks to all my colleagues who have helped me produce and host the show over the past year. Thanks also to all of you for listening. And join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.